Any comments or questions come up from any of you like that? We didn't give you any opportunity. We were too tired last night. If so, we'll try to remember before we end the session if there's ever any questions in that. What we've done in the past, too, where's our leader? He disappeared. It helps sometime if you could put a basket and a pen and some little sheets of paper. Some people might want to ask a question anonymously and put it there where we can get them and we'll do a question and answer session very often. It's very helpful. Sometimes we think we know what you're talking about, but you don't know what the hell we're talking about. So. So I was in Denver, and I had been going to the young people's group, and we had a 1975. They brought an international convention to Denver, and it's interesting the people who were trying to make that invitation work, and it's a ton of work to do those things. Came to our young people's meeting one night and asked if the young people would support an international coming to Denver. And we all thought, well, that way we can all afford to go. And so we agreed to it. And then it just seems like, it was a year or two later, and we were working at that and at the convention on the hospitality committee. And quickly, one story there. I was on the main floor where they were coming in, and they had the registration lines alphabetically, you know, A, B, C, D here, and the next ones, and then that. And they were, a plane would land in Denver, and everybody in the one plane would kind of get in one line, because AAs really don't read and follow directions very well. And they were trying to get to say, hey, you can pick up registrations for more than just yourself. Once you get a group of five or six and one or two, you go up there. Well, this plane landed from California. And so I'm going over there to kind of encourage these people to do that. And I should have known it, but I didn't. And so I kind of go into the last half of the line to start my little conversation, explain it. And I'm told immediately, no, you're going to have to talk to that little guy up front. And so I said, okay. And I walk up front, and I see Clancy I. And I'd been around him a couple of times before. He sees me, he says, what do you want, kid? And I said, I just told him that and all that. And so he stood up on a box and hollered at me, do what this kid says. And so we got the California bunch through pretty quickly, but you had to have Clancy's help. and at that international convention, Mac Cheater talked at an international meeting, and he told about the Golden Slippers group and how so many of them have gotten sober and stayed sober. It hadn't done that before as a result of going through the book as anally as possible, I guess, make it short. And so we ended up getting together and doing that ourselves with Don P. kind of leading the group because he had experience with that in prison. And so that was the first experience I had with that. My experience with the first step, I think I shared pretty well last night. But I really did, in thinking about moving on in the program at that, I knew I was desperate. I knew I had been sober for, at that point in time, I'd been sober almost 4 years. Because I did 3 years of college in the summer before I moved to Denver and got a round step worker. I didn't know anybody that had taken the steps in order before I got to Denver. That ain't no picnic. My first 4 years of sobriety, was miserable as I've ever been in my life. Not drinking and going to meetings does not treat your alcoholism. And I was still waking up scared, and I was still afraid to carry on a conversation. I couldn't look you in the eye to talk. I couldn't be trusted. I had a degree in accounting and couldn't hold a job because everybody thought the bean counter ought to be able to look you in the eye and talk to you. So I was getting fired from that, and it wasn't working well until we finally got in the place. And I don't know, we talked during that time. We would talk to step workers and that, but something happened here when we got together and went through it. So what's happening during that time and during our time and discussions around first step and that sort of thing, I'm going to AA meetings, and I'm watching AA members grow right past me. They seem to be getting their gear together, you know, they're cleaning up their past, they're getting caught up on their child support, and they're doing these things, and hell, I wasn't able to go pick up my bad checks hardly. I wasn't doing a damn thing. And I came to believe that there was a power greater myself that could help me by watching other alcoholics get their gear together in AA and blame it on God. With that. So that was part of my coming to believe. That and being around some people in AA who clearly believed and lived like they believed and weren't behaving like I was. And that was it. And I had a couple of other experiences in there that I think were a part of that. Reading the fourth chapter was a great help, and I stayed in it, and I would read it, and being willing to believe, and I was certainly willing, I was desperate. Life was awful, and I had all I could take. And I was just listening and doing was the biggest part of it. Went to down in Larimer Street on Skid Row was one of those places where the indigents down there could come in, get a shower. I can't think of the name of it.
The Men's Assistance
Center. Men's Assistance Center, yeah. And I was asked to go down there for take an AA meeting down there one night. And I ended up down there, and I'd met a guy down there that was also going to do that meeting with me. He was a Native American, Chiricahua Apache. I don't know what he was doing in Colorado, but he and I were taking that meeting in there. And we had set up back in the room in the back and made a pot of coffee, and we were waiting for people walking in. And there's a couple of two or three Native Americans coming from over here and some from over here, and they weren't acting kind of together. That wasn't doing that. They obviously didn't like each other much. But they all came into the meeting, and we started the meeting, but we started it with the Serenity Prayer. And Vince, the friend that came to me, says, "Let me start this meeting." Because there was really bad feelings in that group of people. And he opened the meeting, and I wish I could remember directly what he said, but the way I remember it, he talked about this is Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only reason we're here is so our lives can change and we can find some peace. Never told you? Have I told you this before? And he says, all these old bad feelings have got to be set aside. We drop them right now. If you want to pick them up after we leave, you can go do it. You guys can go cut your throats, but set it down. And he talked about what AA worked and how it worked. And he says, my friend Gary here normally wears cowboy boots. And if he and I were both drinking, I'll tell you, the cowboy and Indian wars would be going on right now. But there's never been reason to do that because we found a place where there is this spirit that brings us together, and it doesn't matter where we're from or how it happened. And I thought, well, that is true. That is what's going on with me. I get around people I normally wouldn't be around, and we get along fine. Hell, we very often leave liking each other. What a concept. with that, and I haven't thought of that night in a long, long time. We ended up with a good meeting, and a couple of guys that had came in participated, had a little sobriety, and talked about it. And we closed the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. And I'm walking out of there, and I'm walking to my car, and thinking about this business with this higher power. And maybe it was that night that I was convinced that I had seen our higher power in action. Because he brought peace to a room, and there was no peace walking in it when I walked in there with those guys coming in. As a child growing up, I grew up on this experimental farm outside of Cheyenne, and there were 7 or 8 families live out there. Next door to us was a Mormon family. And there was a couple of PhD scientists down in the next 2 houses. And then you got down to people, and there were Lutherans. There were some neighbors down the end that there were church-going people, but I didn't like them. They wouldn't let their kid play with me. I thought everybody should smoke cigarettes by the time they were 10 years old, and those people objected to that. So I didn't know what to think about. The Mormons next door were friendly and nice, and they were always pretty kind. And my dad was about as anti-God as you could get. He's angry. But you have some dry spells, some drought up in Wyoming, Colorado. And a good year around Cheyenne, you get 15, 16 inches of rain a year. Hell, you get that in a month in Georgia. But it gets very, very dry in a desert, and things, the plants start dying and that. My dad used to go over to the Mormons and ask them to pray for rain. Sometimes it rained. But that was as close I ever saw my dad get about that. And so those were my only experience about God. They would drop me off at a Sunday school. My dad, after I found some genealogy in our family, came from a family of itinerant Methodist preachers who wandered across the country carrying their message. And so time it got down to his generation, he was tired of all that in a big way, and he didn't want to hear it. But they thought maybe I should go to church, so they would take me to Sunday school. They'd give me a quarter to go to Sunday school, and they'd drive off. And I'd take the quarter, and I'd watch the car go around the corner and head out. And I'd take my quarter and walk downtown and spend my quarter on candy and Coca-Cola. You notice I say Coca-Cola and not Coke? And so that's just kind of all I knew about that. I didn't know anything. So when I got in here and I'm around people talking about a God and believing it, and I can see something that's working, they change them, and it happens. And that's how I came to believe. I can't tell you there's any other way. And from that, I continually looked and sought and do that. And the more work I did in the steps, the more I believed in God. That sounds backward. It sounds like you got to believe first, doesn't it? It doesn't. Just do what it says. Trust me. It changed my life. You're up.
The book says, are you even willing to believe? And then it says, upon this simple cornerstone, a wonderfully effective spiritual structure can be built. And I lived with my grandparents for a while, and they took me to church, and the minister, this was an evangelical Lutheran church, which means they're pretty aggressive, and they decided when I was like 12 years old that I was going to be a Lutheran minister, and it's damn good that didn't happen for the Lutheran church. Because I would have been screwing all the parishioners. Can you imagine? No. Can you imagine trying to hold a congregation together when the minister's trying to get in everybody's skivvies? So. It says, are you even willing to believe? It doesn't say that you got to know anything. It just says, are you willing? And my background had been studying chemistry. And chemistry is pretty simple. You put this with that, you get that. And and so you wanted proof of what you were looking at. And if you're trying to consider God and you're asking for proof, you might come up a little short. Because you can't see Him, you can't hear Him, you can't smell Him, you can't... It just doesn't appeal to the senses. And so at some point, you are going to have to do something in your spiritual path that is called an act of faith. And if you don't want to do that tough shit, you're out of luck. All right? At some point, you're just going to have to do it because you want to do it. And you aren't going to have any proof. You aren't going to do any of that stuff. And see, I watch people in Alcoholics Anonymous like Gary, and they were changing, and there was no visible proof about why that ought to be going on. They were just changing. And I'm watching these people change, and they had a willingness to believe without any particular evidence. So, I started thinking about, well, just show me something. And it wasn't available. And so my choices were the choices given in the book about God either is or He isn't. He's either everything or He's nothing. And it even says it. What is your choice to be? And at some point, through an act of faith of just saying, well, shit, I'll believe it. And maybe what's happening to all these other people will happen to me. So I tried to believe. You don't have to do anything perfectly. You just have to agree to it. The first thing they told me was that business about ask God in the morning to keep you sober, thank Him at night for keeping you sober. And that seemed to have some effect. And then I got curious. Now, I'll tell you what. In all the years of sobriety that I've had, I think one of the most important components in recovery is spiritual curiosity. You know, at some point I thought, if this thing is saving my life, I'd like to know a little more about it. And so I started chasing this idea about, I wonder how I find out about God. So I looked at all of the I looked at all the descriptions that people use about God: omnipotent, omnipresent. What I've got brain fart. Omniscient. All those things, and those things are all encompassing. It's like omnipotent. There's no beginning and no end to a word like that. I mean, it has no boundaries. And that doesn't make sense to someone who studied chemistry. It just, everything's got a boundary except the spiritual world. Omnipresent, everywhere at once. Whoa. How do you get your arms around that? And so I looked at all those descriptions, and what I finally figured out, even thinking I was as intelligent as I did, I found out I couldn't wrap my mind around it. And my belief was, unless I know what God looks like or something about it, I'm not going to believe in it. And all of a sudden, what I found out was that I couldn't wrap my mind around it, and I never will be able to. And so then the choices are, we'll either do it or don't do it. And what I found out was that if I was willing to believe, my life would change. And that it worked. And that if I was willing to appeal to a God that I couldn't understand, that my life would change. And so I chose to do that. That's the act of faith. No proof, just, hey, I'm watching that over there and that seems to work, so I'm going to try it and see if it works for me. And the more I did it, the more I believed. And the more my life changed. And all of a sudden, things started happening to me that weren't visible, but that were life-changing. One of those things was a quiet mind. You know, my mind, from the time I was a small child, was like a 12-piece band. And all of a sudden, it was quiet. And the first time that happened, it scared me. And it was because, what's going on? I've never experienced that before, and all of a sudden, my mind was quiet. I started seeing the world in a different light. Now, there's a line in the book that I really like, and I think that's pretty explanatory about how the spiritual life affects you. The line in the book is, "We will show you what we have done." Doesn't say we're going to show you what you ought to do. It says we'll show you what we did. Now, what I did was I made a decision that, even without evidence, I made a decision because I was watching things going on around me that had no explanation. I wanted them to happen to me. So I came to believe because my life changed, because it got better. And people can say, what do you know about God today that you didn't know when you were a year sober? Nothing. I choose to believe. I know from experience that God isn't walking around with a sharp stick and a bad sense of humor. And I know that for some odd reason, He cares about my welfare. And I want something like that in my corner. And see, my big deal was, how do I get his attention? I was always afraid of God up to that point because I figured there probably was one, but I didn't know what he was up to. And the more I relied upon him, the more my life improved. Now, how can I prove that to you? I unless you come and stay with me for a while, I don't know how the hell you're going to know that. But I can tell you that when I came into this program, I was pretty much a psychopath. That I'd been collecting loans in Chicago, and I'd been doing all this stuff, and basically all I did was hurt people. And all of a sudden, I started caring about other people's welfare, which was totally out of character for me. I didn't care at all about what happened to other people. It was just business for me. And then all of a sudden, I couldn't bring myself to hurt people. I started doing things to help other people. And I'm shaking my head doing, what the hell are you doing? And all of that came from an act of faith. Okay, I'm willing. And then we started this step group, the one that we've both been talking about in this guy's basement. And we're reading through the second step and all that stuff and about being willing. And then I'm peeking ahead and I'm looking at the third step prayer, right? And I'm going, oh no. And see, my sponsor had come to me and he says, well, look at that and see, what I want you to do is think about it, which is the worst thing you can say to me, because I'll make World War III out of it. And so I looked at this, and this thing says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. You know what I did with that? Oh, no. Maybe God's a Jehovah's Witness. Maybe I'm going to be standing on a street corner in Nairobi handing out religious tracts. And maybe God's going to take me someplace I don't want to be. And given that kind of power to God, my idea was I had a choice. And actually we do, because God's pretty polite in my experience. And every once in a while God wants to change my mind, and I don't want to. And so God will say, Bob, you really need to open your mind about this. And I'll go, no, I don't want to. And he'll say, yeah, you really need to now, and I want you to do that. And I'd go, no, stay away from me. And he'll say, Bob, you got to change your mind. And if you don't want to, I'll change it for you. And I'll go, let go of this. I want this. I want to keep this. It's like staying in a bad relationship. And I'll go, stay away from me. I want to hold on to this. And he'll go, it's killing you. Let go of it. And then he will rip it out of my bloody fingers. And then I'll go, whoa, this is much better. um, You know, if God wants you to change your mind, it'll change. I think that you almost have to agree with it. Because if you want to stay in a situation that's killing you, he'll let you. And at some point, you'll get to the part in the book about intuition, and your intuition will tell you to let go. So I came to believe. I'm not a particularly a religious person. I probably pray more than most religious people. I like talking to God. I don't ask him for stuff. Mostly I just thank him for what he's given me. And he just gives me stuff. And he gives me stuff that's more important to me than the things that people normally want. The big three that people always want are money, sex, and power. Okay? I don't much care about. I mean, all that stuff comes, I guess, if you are engaged in the right things. In quantities that are irrelevant. It just, having things like a quiet mind are so much more important to me than all the rest of that stuff. And frankly, I have all the rest of that stuff. But being able to just sit here without having my mind running all over the place and feeling, you normally, if you were sitting up here, you'd feel like you're compelled to say something bright. I'm not. I'm compelled to say what's ever in my mind. Now, sometimes I am a profane person. So sometimes things come out of my mouth that don't sound like someone practicing a spiritual program. Tough shit. It just, you know, and who gets to define spiritual anyway? You know, all I care about is, can you hear me or not? And what I want to do is I want to tell you that if you're willing to do some things that are out of character for you, that you may find some really outrageous surprises. And one of those things, are you even willing to believe? And then one of the things that's made Alcoholics Anonymous such an outrageous experience for me is the willingness to change my mind. You know, I didn't want to go anywhere near God because I figured with my life up to that point that he was pissed anyway. And when I found out, when I started practicing faith, I found out that God rewarded me with things that I hadn't even considered. The joy of my life are 5 sons and 3 grandsons. They really are. I just love him. I mean, my youngest grandson's 2 years old, and he's an absolute delight. You watch 2-year-olds, and they're, you know, they are in the moment. And I was at his second birthday in Dallas a couple of weeks ago. I have five sons. Two of them are drunks. One's 10 years sober and one is 4 years sober. And I watched that, and the one that's 4 years sober, both of them wound up in comas. The one that's 4 years sober was going to Colorado State University, and he would buy like four handles of vodka, lock himself in a room. He wouldn't eat for 3 or 4 days, and he'd just sit in there and drink, and finally they'd have to call the fire department and knock down his door and take him to the emergency room. And then I'd get a call, and I'd have to drive up to Fort Collins, and I'd go in the emergency room, and he'd look at me, and he'd be looking real sheepish, and say he was sorry and all that stuff. And he got out of, we put him in a tree, his mother and I put him in a treatment center. And I was appalled by that place. And when he got out, he said, he asked me what I was going to do to help him. And I said, nothing. I can't do it. You know why? Because I called him and I said, what do I do? My son's in a treatment center and he's really messed up, and if he keeps doing what he's doing, he'll be dead within a year. You know what he told me? Keep your goddamn hands off him. So I did.
It was a little more crude than that.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't doing that with my hands at the time. And my son went out and joined a group, Frank McKibben's group.
God Squad.
Yeah, and which is a group, I wouldn't even go to their meeting. But they're step workers. They are hard step workers. There's just some other things I don't agree with. But he joined that group. He went through the steps. He got a sponsor that was a real step worker. And he is just coming up on his fourth birthday. And I'm watching this. He flunked out of Colorado State University. And when he got sober, he went to Metropolitan State University in Denver, and next month he graduates with a degree in civil engineering, straight A student. And the month after that, he marries his sweetheart. And he wants me to stand up there in a tuxedo with him. You have no idea how strange it is. Putting a tuxedo on me is like putting a tuxedo on an ape. I just don't belong in one. You know, I own a business that provides psychiatric care for the Colorado Department of Corrections. I have a staff of psychiatrists that I provide direction to. And this guy in a meeting one time, he says, what the hell is it about your history that allows you to give direction to doctors? And I said, I own the business. How's that happen? I'm an old gangster. I mean, I'm an old thug. And it wasn't until I wrote inventory about all that stuff that I really found out that I wasn't who I thought I was. And one of the things that we're going to do here today is to give you the tools to change your mind about who you are. You know, I was going to spend the rest of my life thinking that the only thing I was good at was hurting people. And what I found out is that I am an astute business person. That I'm pretty bright, as a matter of fact. And that I am not only somewhat good about running businesses, I am very good at running businesses. And it's no mystery. You want to know what the secret is? Watch the money. And, you know, for an old thug like me, University of Colorado, CU, came to me and asked me to become a professor at the university to teach small business. And I said, why the hell are you asking me? And they said, you've got a reputation that precedes you about running very, very well-run businesses. How the hell did that happen? You could spend the rest of your life never knowing what you are good at unless you have the courage to risk, to try things that would have scared the bejesus out of you before. And one of the things that you can find in Alcoholics Anonymous and in this spiritual program of growth is the willingness to go out and risk. To find out. You know, everybody's so damn concerned about how they look. I'm going to tell you a real secret that most people never find out in their whole lives. And I'll tell you that in about 1 minute. Everyone's so afraid to not look good and how that's going to affect how other people treat them and all the rest of that. And here's the secret. No one's looking. Nobody gives a shit. Do you know that? Everybody is so concerned about themselves that they aren't even looking at us. And so spending all this time worrying about how you look, total waste of time. You look the way you look. You know, I've said some things up here that are profane and insulting and some other things, and I don't see anybody throwing tomatoes at me. Getting out of your own head is a blessing. So, here's what's happened to me ever since I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. At one point, I made a decision to make this an adventure. It's based on the idea that I know nothing about spirituality and I want to know something. And that I'm going to go looking for it and I'm going to go see what effect that has on my life. So I pursue spirituality. And the rewards of that are just incredible to me. And I would rather make life an adventure than drudgery. I want to get up and be excited about what might happen. You know, when I was coming down here, and you guys have all know, I've said it like 50 times that I had to get up at 3:45 in the morning.
Didn't bother you a damn bit, did it?
And I was going, this is just bullshit. I get up in the middle of the night, I'm 79 goddamn years old. They're going. And then I thought, but I don't know what's going to happen down there. See? All I know is I'm going to Georgia. I don't know what the camp looks like. I don't know what you look like. I don't know what you think like. I don't know what the hell's going to happen. But I know something's going to happen, and more likely than not, something good. Because I know that both my intent and Gary's intent is to open your mind, to get you to be willing to change your mind about what you believe. To open it up and say, if there is a God, let me see that. Not only let me see that, let me see what I ought to do. Do you know the greatest thing about intuition? And I probably shouldn't talk about that till later, but half the world is running around in little tight circles going, now what do I do? And intuition will tell you. Intuition, I think God speaks to us through group conscience as a group, but I think God speaks to us through intuition, through intuitive thought, as individuals. And that if you are constantly bumping up against, I don't know what to do now, intuition will solve the problem. But you have to practice at it. It's like so many other things in AA. But if you practice intuitive thought, you will be amazed. There's a description of it in the book that says we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That's asking for intuitive thought. And see, I work with seriously mentally ill inmates. Now that means they're not only antisocial, they're dangerous. And I'm too stupid to be afraid. I've been around people who want to shoot you most of my life. So, when we went through the steps, we decided that we were really going to practice this stuff, that we weren't just going to, you know, give it agreement. We were going to really practice it. And so this pause thing is something that we practice. And I get in a room full of seriously mentally ill inmates, and all of a sudden somebody'd start acting out. And I'd go over there and say, you better take that down a couple of notches. And and most of the time they do that, but every once in a while somebody get in my face, and what would happen is I wouldn't step back. If anything, I would step forward. But my mind would be going, God, show me what's going on here. Give me the right thought or action. And I'm standing in front of somebody that's 4 inches taller than I am and 50 pounds heavier. And I'm saying, God, show me what's happening here. And I would get an answer every time. And with one small exception, nothing ever happened. I played 15 years of competitive judo, and in 20 years of dealing with mentally ill inmates, I've only been attacked once, and it wasn't, you know, some 6'8" psychopath. It was a 5'10" Puerto Rican from New York named Angel. And he was disrupting a group I was doing. And I said, excuse me, shut the fuck up. And he ran at me. Now, normally the other inmates in the room will prevent that, because if one gets in trouble, they all get in trouble. So, but nobody had a chance to react. And I mean, he was next to me before anybody knew what was going on. And so he's running at me, and all that muscle memory came into play. And I threw him over my shoulder, over a table. And he landed flat on his back on a cement floor, and it knocked the wind out of him. And I knelt down next to him, and I said, "You want to do this some more?" And he said, "No, sir, I don't." And that's the only time I've ever been attacked, and all the time I've been working with inmates. So anyway, what do you got to lose? I mean, if your life is so pleasant that you don't want it to change at all, you may be making a mistake just sitting in here. Because this is really about changing your mind. And I know that's difficult, because it was difficult for me. But how are you going to find anything out? The thing that really fertilizes your mind is a willingness to change it. And one of the first things you might want to consider is, are you willing to believe? And then see what happens.
I've been talking too long. Let's take a break.